Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. Over the past year, unlikely challengers have emerged to the dominant politics of the center-left in both the US and the UK. Jeremy Corbyn is looking increasingly poised to win the leadership of the UK Labour Party next month. Meanwhile, on this side of the Atlantic, Bernie Sanders keeps rising in the polls, drawing large crowds, and making Hillary Clinton's coronation as Democratic presidential candidate a bit uncertain. Both Sanders and Corbyn are silver-haired, decades-long parliamentarians, identified with a marginalized left and would have been at home in pre-1970s social democracy. After years of rightward drift, though, from both Labour and the Democrats, this old guard of social democracy is making one more stand. Both Sanders and Corbyn have set their sights on economic inequality and economic stagnation for the majority as defining issues, and Sanders in particular has also talked widely about reclaiming the political system from under the influence of big money. This week's guests join me to talk about the Sanders and Corbyn campaigns, where they're coming from, what they mean, and what we can expect from them. First, I speak with Bhaskar Sunkara about Bernie Sanders and his qualified support for Bernie's campaign. Bhaskar is the editor of Jacobin magazine, which has quickly become one of the most widely read media venues on the US left. My second guest is James Medway, an economist and activist from the UK. James recently signed a letter from UK economists in support of Jeremy Corbyn and has been following Corbyn's campaign closely. First up, though, Bhaskar Sunkara, and who is Bernie Sanders?
So Bernie Sanders is the senator from Vermont. He is technically a independent, but he caucuses with the Democratic Party. Previously, for many years, he was a congressman from Vermont, from the district around Burlington. And before that, he was the mayor of Burlington. So he's done all this as an independent, affiliated with, you know, Vermont Third Party. But in fact, once he's come to Washington, he's just by nature, because of the American party systems, always caucused with the Democrats. But this is the first time he's running in a Democratic primary. He's a self-described Democratic socialist, which is extremely unusual for a mainstream American politician, to say the least. And yeah, that's basically the gist. He's essentially running on a platform that is reminiscent of the right wing of 1960s social democracy, but in the European context. But, you know, for today in America, that's well to the left of any other viable presidential or even semi-viable presidential candidate.
Yeah, and I think another interesting point or something that makes him a fair bit different is that he's really staked out economic issues as his main focus, and ones that should be, you know, relevant to the majority of people: stagnant wages, crappy jobs, enormous inequality. You know, he talks about the billionaire class versus the rest, widespread poverty. What's the significance of this, of really staking out these economic issues?
Sanders' rhetoric, even though it is kind of soft in certain ways, he does do the classic thing, which is not very common in American politics, of actually pushing a polarization. So he actually talks about the billionaire class and how their interests are opposed to those of working people. And he proposes, you know, basic redistribution and also the decommodification of certain parts of the economy, like healthcare or education. He's been campaigning strongly on free public higher education and things like that. So I would say that kind of rhetoric and that emphasis is very unusual, because obviously most candidates are not going to be running really on this kind of economic platform. For most Democrats in the New Democrat tradition, they'd be arguing for their prowess as administrators. So the fact that they could kind of deliver fixes and improve things around the edges and deliver kind of clean, competent government, and also the fact they're not as bellicose, they claim at least, as the Republicans. While on the other side, actually economic issues factor quite a bit in the Republican debates, especially now that they seem to be losing some ground on certain cultural fronts, like gay marriage and so on. You know, essentially with the Republicans, you know, they're talking about cutting taxes, they're talking about stimulating growth, they're talking about how certain entitlements and other obligations hurt American workers as they try to ascend up the American class ladder and so on. So I wouldn't actually say that Bernie's injecting the economy into the presidential campaign, because it would be there anyway. The only thing that he's injecting is perspectives broadly in the interest of working people and the type of programs that that workers all across the world is traditionally supported, which is broad-based social democratic programs around redistribution. So that's what's new.
Right, and I guess this is something different in the Democratic Party, since a lot of the other candidates would be funded by the very sort of big business interests that he's campaigning against.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, so the big thing with Sanders, though, is that even though he doesn't benefit from having the same sort of business interest and so on, it's not like he's also running with the support of major labor unions. So the best thing that Sanders can hope for, at least for now, it seems, is that major unions don't officially endorse for Hillary Clinton. Some of them have actually jumped the gun very early on, more than a month ago. The AFT, the teachers union, or one of the two largest teacher unions in the U.S., endorsed Clinton. And, you know, that was kind of to preempt any sort of grassroots upsurge or individual endorsements by locals. And there was kind of warning sent from the AFL heads. That, you know, any kind of endorsements by individual locals in this kind of presidential race would be, you know, frowned upon, that, you know, it wasn't something they could do. So I think in many ways, even though some progressive unions and locals will be broken off to Sanders, the best thing he could expect is getting the active support of rank and file members of the labor movement as individuals. And also, hopefully, some of these big unions not deploying resources or officially endorsing Clinton until after she wins the Democratic nomination.
And what's the relationship between some of these other sort of grassroots or quasi-grassroots movements, like the Fight for 15 or like some of the things associated with that, and the Sanders campaign, or in general, sort of the grassroots? It seems like he's, you know, able to fill stadiums with over 20,000 people regularly, but most people still say he won't ultimately gain the nomination. Is there something more lasting that can be sort of built from this campaign that's ultimately, at this point, just, you know, sort of constricted in time?
Right. So one thing is, we're so early. It's August, right? So we're actually, somehow we've jumped the gun on discussing this race in many ways. So even when it comes to, let's say, your question about how, you know, people involved with Fight for 15 or other movements are relating to Sanders, like, my only answers would be purely anecdotal. So I would hesitate to actually answer that definitively at all. I would say that it does seem that Sanders is mobilizing a huge layer of people who otherwise would not be part of the, not be necessarily voting, would not necessarily be excited about a candidate. This is, for a lot of people, their first experience really getting excited about a politician. The amount of rallies that he's drawing, you know, the tens of thousands of people in L.A., Portland, Seattle. This is new, especially for this stage of the campaign. This is, you know, much better than what Dean, who's often, I think, unfairly compared to, and others have done. Because, you know, for very good reasons, and I say this as someone who's very much opposed to the orientation that most people have towards the Democratic Party. Like, I don't think it's a party that can be moved leftwards. I think that ultimately we need to break with the Democratic Party and create something else. The question is how we get there. And that's one of the reasons why I'm, as you say, cautiously supporting Sanders. But if you think about the reasons why, let's say a lot of the poorest communities in the United States, say a lot of Black working class communities, are a Democratic Party stalwarts. It's not, it's sometimes phrased in the mainstream media as some sort of psychological attachment to the Clintons, you know, Bill Clinton, the first Black president, that kind of thing. But it more has to do with the fact that these people know the actual material dangers of a Republican getting elected. And so lesser evilism, you know, is a perfectly rational choice for a lot of these Democratic Party supporters. So that's why that produces a strong push towards supporting the presumptive nominee, the most electable person, were the most so the that kind of like push towards incumbency.
Mm-hmm.
So if Sanders is able to prove his electability and he gets more visible and he performs well at the debates, that kind of thing will help really bolster his support. So it goes hand in hand. Sanders closing the gap with Clinton goes hand in hand with Sanders winning over this debate about his electability and presidential, you know, bona fides.
And speaking of, I mean, especially the Black community in the U.S. and other communities of color, I mean, some of the loudest news around Sanders has been around his racial justice platform, or for a long time, a sort of lack of one. There's been the disruptions by the Black Lives Matter movement and a lot of discussion around that. How important is this in the campaign? How, you know, to what extent is Bernie Sanders weak on racism in the U.S.? To what extent is this a movement pushing Sanders? To what extent is this a media storm? What's going on with this sort of latest chapter? And again, as you said, it's early.
Right. I mean, can it be a little bit of everything, right? So in certain ways, so Sanders, this is one of the reasons why I think a lot of my fellow Sanders supporters have been a bit defensive. Sanders' record actually stands up very well against any other mainstream politician on a lot of the issues that Black Lives Matter activists and other people care about. That's definitely true. But it's also true that it wasn't a major emphasis of his campaign and a speech in his speeches early on before the Netroots Nation intervention. And also in his actual platforms, you know, the policy papers that his team released and so on, it just wasn't an emphasis. It is much more of an emphasis now. So it is true there was some deficiencies in Sanders' campaign. But of course, the reason why many were compelled to support Sanders isn't necessarily because of his program. It's the same reason why many of us supported, well, I was like 10 years old at the time, but would have supported Ralph Nader in 2000, right? Because if you look at his program, Nader is actually well to the right of Sanders on a lot of key issues. The point is that, like, the Sanders campaign, the movement and energy around him bodes well to energizing and activating people, moving the discourse left in a way that will create better conditions and space for movements to grow in the future and potentially down the road help lay out the conditions in which there could actually be a leftward break from the Democratic Party. So obviously this is completely speculative, and this is an example that we're pushing. But it's never been about, though, the exact program. So I think sometimes we get defensive and say, oh, well, Sanders is actually great on these issues. No, he's not great on these issues. He's okay on these issues, like a lot of social Democrats are okay on these issues. But we have much more sweeping, substantive things we want to do to create a more equal and just country. So I always try to draw that distinction between supporting Sanders' campaign and also not necessarily like line by line approving of his program. But the key point is that the social movement, a level of social struggle in the United States, is at fairly low. And Sanders is a very good candidate considering the level of social movement struggles. If we want a better candidate, then we have to build stronger movements. We have to create a different infrastructure to produce these candidates and so on.
Yeah, and I guess that gets beyond this sort of simplistic, you know, movements versus Sanders type thing where you can say that, you know, it seems like some of the disruptions have been effective and have pushed them. But on the other hand, there's no sort of a positionality.
Right, exactly. I think the key is there is that potential danger that we need to acknowledge that the Sanders campaign energy would kind of lead to a morphing of itself into the left wing of the Clinton campaign if he endorses Clinton in April. So that's all the more reason to not defensively rally around Sanders and defend him, but actually draw that distinction between Sanders a candidate, Sanders a politician, he's not a great politician in many ways, and what Sanders represents and what Sanders can do, not for the left, but just the left, but for these broader movements and these broader causes. And I think that distinction is important. So just like there's that threat of the NGOization of especially horizontal movements like Black Lives Matter, there's also that even more present, even more dangerous threat of the Sanders campaign itself and all this energy morphing into nothing more than let's make Hillary honest on these issues. Let's keep her honest, you know.
maybe as a very last thing, I mean, this campaign comes at a moment to move out a little bit too. You know, we have Corbyn in the UK, we have these sort of anti-austerity parties in Europe, in Turkey, there seems to be something bubbling. There's definitely the polarization that you've been talking about isn't just a U.S. thing. How exceptional sort of is American politics, or can we place, you know, not Sanders himself, but this campaign and this debate that's sort of opening up in the States into this broader trend, or is this still something a bit different?
Yeah, I think you definitely can. So essentially, it's happening through the Democratic Party because of the peculiarities of our, single member district, system. And that's also the reason why it's happening in the Labour Party as opposed to in the Green Party or another left formation in the UK. The difference, of course, is that we've never actually even got to the point of constructing a Labour Party in the United States. So it's happening through a social liberal party. But it's part of the same kind of trend of establishment politicians getting discredited and there being a vacuum for alternative politics and discourses. And, you know, what's key to also remember is that in the 1980s, there was never a majority support for the new Labour policies or new Democrat policies. So the common myth that has been told by the, let's say, the right wing of these center-left movements, in the case of the New Labour, for example, is that this was all a move about electability instead of a very ideological-driven class project, you know, also connected to a real crisis of profitability and so on. So, you know, in many ways, the base of the Democratic Party and those who aren't active Democrats but are not voting and are broadly for Sanders or other candidates is for these kind of broad programs, social democratic programs of redistribution. And so this is not necessarily even a new development. I would say that obviously since the crisis, there's a lot less energy behind the idea that, hey, you know, we'll give you a low interest loan and a whatever else, and you could be part of the ownership society. There's less of that. But I would say this is nothing particularly new. It's just a matter of actually, you know, articulating these politics and building class discourse. So the final thing I would say is that, you know, it's true of the, why are American workers less class conscious than Swedish workers? It has no cultural causes. It has no social causes. The only cause is really the political cause of the fact that we have not built parties and organizations that have on a mass scale articulated class politics. So as a result, American workers do not interpret their lived experiences through these exact languages, but they're very much capable of doing so. So there's a reason why Sanders' rhetoric is resonating, because it's not completely abstracted. It's rooted in what people are seeing around them every day.
That was Bhaskar Sankara, editor of Jacobin Magazine, talking about Bernie Sanders' run for the Democratic nomination. Next, my conversation with James Midway about Jeremy Corbyn's run for the leadership of British Labour. Well, why don't we start with, you know, who is Jeremy Corbyn, and maybe even more so, why is his run for leader of the Labour Party drawing such excitement, and why is he this sort of outsider candidate poised to win?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn's a very long-standing Labour MP. He was first elected back in 1983 for a constituency in London, for Islington, quite a deprived place, and a very, very popular local MP by all accounts. I mean, he's increased his majority at every election that he's stood in, I think is the figure. It's obvious he's well-liked locally and generally considered to be a very good sort of local MP. But he's also someone who has remained consistently on the left of the Labour Party right the way through his career. He's always been someone who was central to the protests against the Iraq War, for example, who has opposed Tony Blair when he was Prime Minister, and then Gordon Brown when he was Prime Minister, voted against his own whip, I think, more times than any other single MP in Parliament. So he's someone who's always been a kind of rebel like that. And in particular, when the Labour Party has shifted so far to the right, his status as an outsider has just grown and grown by default. I mean, he hasn't moved move very much. One of the things people say is very, very consistent, very principled. So he hasn't moved. The rest of the Labour Party has moved and moved a very long way to the right. So he's a complete outsider in all of this. The reason he's able to stand at all for this election is due to two things. One of them is that the Labour Party changed its rules last year about how its leader would be elected. It used to have a slightly complicated electoral college system in which the different parts of the party, the parliamentary party, so that's the MPs, the party members, that's people who actually pay to be a member, and then the actual several million people who are members of affiliated trade unions. They all have a vote, but those votes are weighted differently. So if you're a trade union who's voting in the election, your vote is a tiny fraction of what an MP's vote is worth. It's the electoral college system. That was abolished last year in the belief by the Blairites, by the kind of hard right of the Labour Party, that this would help diminish even further the influence of the trade unions and the left in general, that they just put everyone in a kind of one member, one vote footing, one person, one vote footing. And that would mean that the unions weren't able to steer in any way, really, how the party operated. This was seemingly in the belief that if you opened up party elections like this, if you created this new category of a registered supporter, somebody who just pays £3 to go and vote in the election, then the party would be flooded with all these enthusiastic Blairites who are out there secretly itching to vote for, you know, complete non-entities that the kind of right of the party put up. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that in order to get on the ballot paper at all, the nomination process is controlled by MPs. And to get on there, you need 35 MPs to say that they will support you being on the ballot paper for the election, which goes out to the entire electorate in the party. And quite a few, I mean, look, to be honest with you, there's about maybe 15, 20 actually left-wing Labour MPs in Parliament, in the usual sense of people who would support Jeremy Corbyn. In order to get on the ballot paper, quite a few other MPs basically loaned their nominations to him, seemingly in the belief for some of them that he would just get totally humiliated, that the left would do incredibly badly in the election, that it would be another demonstration that the left is irrelevant, that it would make it easier for the party to continue its move to the right, and that everything would just be, you know, smoothly managed process. Now, what's actually happened is the combination of these two deep miscalculations by essentially the Labour right, by Tony Blair's erstwhile followers, that first of all, changing the electoral system would diminish trade union influence and diminish the influence of the left, and second of all, that the left would get utterly humiliated, had proved to be completely wrong. I mean, as of today, Labour Party membership, including these new registered supporters, has gone up by about 310,000 since the election, maybe close to 400,000 actually by now, and that's risen from about 200,000 at the election. So it's more than doubled the membership and the base of support for the Labour Party in the space of, a couple of months. So it's dramatic, is what's taking place.
And what about Corbyn's program itself, too? I mean, I think one aspect that's drawn a lot of attention is his economic program. You're an economist. I saw you signed this open letter just, I think, today or yesterday in support of him. I think there's even been a moniker coined, Corbynomics. What is this? What's his program? What makes it stand out, and what makes it sort of, you know, also kind of concentrate opposition?
Well, the issue here, I think, is, I mean, the program itself, if you look at it sort of fairly objectively, it's basically kind of moderate Keynesianism. This is not really saying anything that radical. It's saying we will not use austerity to try and close the deficit, the government fiscal deficit. So we won't impose huge, great spending cuts. We will go after tax avoidance and tax evasion much more thoroughly than is being done at present. And we will increase taxes on the rich. And we will look to bring back some of the things like utilities, water companies, electricity companies, railway companies that have been privatised in the last 20, 30 years. We'll look to bring them back into some form of public and collective ownership. This isn't particularly dramatic, right? This isn't saying all power to the Soviets or anything like this. It's just another indicator of just how far out of touch and how far neoliberalized, if you like, or how far dedicated the sort of Westminster bubble, the mainstream of British political life, is now to kind of neoliberal economics, that this is considered to be dangerously radical stuff. I mean, it really just isn't. But again, it's met with this kind of hysteria and jumping up and down, and this is turning the clock back, and all sorts of other kind of fairly nonsensical stuff. The one wrinkle in this, I suppose, the bits that are more radical in some senses than perhaps the sort of more standard kind of Keynesian or semi-Keynesian program that Corbyn's got, is the issue of using quantitative easing.
Right, this people's QE.
Yeah, people's quantitative easing to finance big infrastructure projects, which has sparked off quite a debate about the role of quantitative easing over the last few years. I mean, if memory serves, I think Canada did actually in the past itself finance big infrastructure projects through a similar process right up through the 70s, to a similar process to what Corbyn's proposing here with people's QE. So there's been a bit of a debate and a reasonably interesting one around that. I mean, a reasonably useful one in terms of advancing questions of like, who is it and what do we mean when we say the Bank of England's independent? What do we do about these enormous concentrations of financial power in our society? It's forced open some of those questions. But it's an indicator of how far things have moved, that this basically not particularly radical program, something that, you know, fairly moderate parties 20 years ago would have stood on to get elected on in this country, is treated as if it's, you know, the return of Trotsky or something like this. It's quite a mad reaction it's provoked. And again, the reaction seems to have made absolutely zero difference whatsoever to the amount of support Corbyn's getting. And you're talking rallies in places up and down the country which have been sort of politically extremely quiet. I mean, what was the one recently? Llandudno in Wales. I mean, it's a little, very small seaside town up in North Wales. They had a meeting of like 500-600. It's the biggest thing anyone can remember there for years and years. Extraordinary amount of support that's come out. And I think it just indicates that the real disaffection that people have for conventional politics, this sort of desperate thirst for something, anything at all, that doesn't just say you have to do austerity, you have to do privatisation, shut up and do as you're told forevermore, that politics doesn't have to be like this. And that's why he's getting his support.
Yeah, but it seems like the policies themselves, you know, things like renationalizing the railways, are actually popular across a whole swathe of UK society and this kind of broader anti-austerity program. Is Corbyn part of this sort of Europe-wide current of anti-austerity that's come out? And, you know, in what ways does he fit into that? In what ways is this still maybe something a bit different?
I mean, you're absolutely right. The core bits of his program, like renationalisation of the railways and the electricity companies and this sort of thing, are hugely popular. I mean, you can even find a majority of Conservative voters who say they would support renationalisation of the railways, that kind of thing. So it's very, very popular. The fact that these things aren't considered any part of polite, you know, mainstream political discourse is indicative, again, of that kind of gap that's opened up between great numbers of people in this country and what official politics will allow them to talk about. And it's that gap, I think, that is where the similarity between what's happening with Corbyn and what's happening in Europe is most apparent. I mean, what you've seen in Europe, in particular in the South, you know, sort of Syriza most dramatically, Podemos to a similar extent in Spain. You can see similar movements taking place on a smaller scale in Portugal. You can see Sinn Féin in Ireland. These parties that have emerged, either completely new or otherwise confined to what pretty much the fringes of political life over the last few years in reaction to austerity, with clear anti-austerity messages appearing and often taking the place of what were otherwise the very well-established parties of the centre-left, of the kind of social democratic parties, if you like, PASOK in Greece, the Socialist Party in Spain, the Labour Party in Ireland. You can see how these new formations or these older formations suddenly given a massive new lease of life have moved from the fringes into the mainstream. And something similar has happened with Corbyn. It's just that instead of it being a new organisation or one that was previously on the fringes, like Syriza, let's say, you know, this is a party that in 2009 was getting 4% of the vote. Instead of it being a new formation or one that's on the fringes, it's all happened inside the Labour Party, which is the peculiarity. So what you can see happening inside the Labour Party now is that kind of Syriza, this radical party of the left in Greece versus PASOK, the old centre-left party. That fight is taking place inside the Labour Party. So instead of it being two different organisations, it's now just inside the Labour Party itself. And it's wreaking havoc on any consideration the right had about what they might do. I mean, they really are very, very uncertain about how to respond to this. It's not entirely clear what they'll do if and when Corbyn's actually elected on the 12th of September. But it's clear, I think, that we're entering a potentially very dramatic, exciting time in British politics one way or the other, precisely because that anti-austerity, populist dynamic is starting to play out in Britain as well. Or rather in England. Of course, you've seen something like this already take place in Scotland with the independence vote and the rise of the SNP.
What are the lessons? I mean, sitting here in Canada and looking what's happening across the board in the States too, I mean, what are the lessons from a campaign like Corbyn's for, you know, even these sort of mild Keynesian anti-austerity forces within this orbit of a more Anglo-Saxon capitalism, where so much of the political fight is still over this kind of, you know, extreme center?
Yeah. It's, I mean, I think there's two things I'd take from this. It's, I mean, there are some particular kind of British issues here. Like, you're dealing in many ways with an entire generation of people who've not had a political home for about 20 years now. You know, if you're on the left and young in this country, there aren't actually that many options to vote for, not big, credible ones. There's no space for you, really. There's been big protest movements, you know, around the war, around student tuition fees, I mean, all sorts of things, around austerity, all sorts of things rumbling on for a long period of time, but no kind of political home there. So in some ways, this has kind of opened the floodgates. It's suddenly revealed this political space people move into. It may not be the case that same situation applies in the rest of, sort of the, you know, the Anglosphere or the English-speaking world or whatever. I think one of the other, but the lesson that does seem to have more generality, and I'm a bit wary about overdoing this point, because I think some people did overdo it a few years back, but it's the role of social media and the ability to generate connections and networks that do not have to run through the older centralized power structures, if you like. Like, to a very large extent, this campaign for Jeremy Corbyn has been driven by social media, which is not the same as saying it's just on social media. I think what the campaign has got right is its ability to use social media to generate databases of people who want to volunteer, and then to turn that into boots on the ground, effectively. That's why you have these enormous rallies. And then that process is the one that starts to deliver what looks like being a very, very substantial vote. So it's the use of social media and the way in which it can disrupt existing sources of authority, I think, is a very, very effective demonstration of that we've seen with the Corbyn campaign. But to do that effectively, I think you do have to be someone who's oppositional. You have to look like, and Jeremy Corbyn, you know, whatever else you might say about him, is very obviously oppositional to all of this. You have to look like someone who's untainted by the centre in one form or another.
That was James Meadway, economist and activist from the UK, talking about Jeremy Corbyn's Labour leadership bid. That's all for this week. Talk to you again in 2 weeks.